welcome to episode 133 of Breakout Culture. I'm Ed Vasey and I'm the culture editor at Country and Townhouse magazine.
I'm Charlotte Metcalf. I'm the associate editor at Country and Townhouse.
And this week we're talking about theatre and we're very excited because we have with us an actor who many of our listeners will know extremely well as one of the most familiar faces on television. He's played David Marsden in the long-running series of Cold Feet. He was Mark Taylor in Joking Apart. And if you're possibly too young to have watched either of those, more recently he played Sir Anthony Strallan in Downton Abbey, among many, many, many more roles. I am, of course, talking about Robert Bathurst, and we couldn't be more delighted that he's here to tell us about his latest theatrical role. Good morning, Robert.
Morning, Charlotte. Morning, Ed.
Good morning, Robert. We're absolutely thrilled we managed to get you on. And we also have with us Trish Wadley, who hails from Australia. She's now a London-based theatre producer, a four times Olivier Award nominee. She specialises in creating innovative work in theatres and other locations in London and around the UK, as well as New York and Australia. Good morning, Trish.
Good morning, Ed. Good morning, Charlotte.
Well, good morning, Trish. It's great to have you both with us. And let's kick off with you, Robert, because you are reprising the title role in Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell Inside, Geoffrey Bernard's favourite Soho pub, The Coach and Horses. You're doing this twice a night for a short run until November the 21st, but you've already had absolutely rave reviews. So tell our listeners what to expect and why you decided to take on the role again.
Well, I used to read Geoffrey Bernard in the Spectator, doing his Low Life column. Alexander Chancellor commissioned him to write this column, which he did for 15 years. Because he recognised someone who was the genuine article, in the sense that he lived in Soho in a manner which wasn't just being a weekend boho, you know. He was the proper thing, and he had this wonderful turn of phrase, and it turned out to be what Jonathan Meads referred to as a 15-year suicide note. Because he was essentially killing himself, and he was drinking in the Coach and Horses. He was drinking in Jerry's bar and the Colony Room and all those other things like that. And he chronicled his misadventures. Well, he, as a sporting life writer, as a writer of racing, he used to write from the perspective of a loser. That was his sort of shtick, really. And but in writing about sort of losing, it was quite elegiac, really, in many ways, and so Keith Waterhouse put together this play from his writing, and turned it into a play set in the Coach and Horses bar, and they put it on stage, and it was called Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell. It was something that the Spectator used to write when he was too drunk to write his column. They used to do that. In fact, they didn't always write that. He claims in the play that, in fact, the Spectator used to more often say something along the lines of, Geoffrey Bernard's column will not be appearing this week as it is remarkably similar to that which he wrote last week. So
I hadn't heard that before. That's quite funny.
And Waterhouse created this play, or adapted his writing to make this play. And then the opportunity came along to perform it actually in the coach. I mean, it's set in the coach. It's not a major stretch to place it in the coach, but it's quite rare to be able to do that. And I did it about 3 years ago, and now I've got another run at it at the moment.
I must say, I can't wait to see it in the coach, because I saw Peter O'Toole do it when it first... What date was that? Can you remember, Robert?
Because I can't. That was 89, yes. I saw it then as well. So, yes, he did it, and Ned Sherrin directed it, and they had five actors in it. They had four people doing scenes from Bernard's life, and O'Toole would be sitting at the bar doing his talking. But I always thought that Ned Sherrin, and Waterhouse perhaps, put in four other actors in it just to stop O'Toole from going mad every night, just sort of sitting on his own. And so maybe just gave him some company. But no, this is an hours version adapted by James Hillier. And I do it on my own. I'm in the bar and I walk around inside the pub, stepping over dogs, stepping over legs. A cat walked across the across the bar when I was doing it. And it's very sort of immediate.
But the landlord as well is just as much a character in the column. Is he a character in the play as well?
He is, yes, indeed. The premise is that Bernard has been locked in all night. He fell asleep in the lav. And Norman Ballen, who he's trying to contact at 5 in the morning to get him out of the pub, is at home, and is Norman going to arrive? Norman is this offstage figure, but and he complains to Norman eventually. He said, you know, why he fell asleep in the bog, and why the hell don't you call time, gents, please, in the gents? And he sort of shouts at him. So Norman is this bogey figure. Obviously they have a sort of rather good symbiotic relationship, swearing at each other. And Norman is a very alive figure in the thing, but he's an offstage character down the phone.
How does the play work in The Coach and Horses? Because you were saying that it's very disruptive to the running of the pub, but presumably the whole pub is taken over by the play.
Yeah, we did the show twice a night at 8 and 10, which means the pub has to close at 7. And we do it on Sunday, Mondays and Tuesdays, which is notionally their least busy time. But The Coach and Horses is a very popular pub, so... It means that they have to shut up. The seating is arranged because all the benches, and we cram about 70 people in, including standing. And so it means that the regulars have to be turfed out, and then the theatre people are allowed in, the ticket holders are allowed in at about sort of 7:30, 7:45. And then the play goes on for an hour, and then we have an hour off, and then the show goes again at 10, and it finishes at 11. So it is, and the staff are there. So it is understandably disruptive. They're very supportive.
Presumably the punters are allowed to buy a pint and a packet of prawn cocktail crisps while they're watching the play.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and everybody's got their drink in their hand, and everybody, yes, they do. They call time 5 minutes before the show starts, and everybody sort of settles back. And then also after the show, yeah, they do. They pile in. So yes, there is the business is turning for them, but it's a different way of doing business, bringing theatre people into it.
How many people at a time can watch?
It's just under 70, I think,
it is, and
they're standing there. Some of them are standing, some of them are sitting, and there's various people sitting at the bar stools. So when somebody you know well, or a journalist is sitting at the bar stool, the journalist sitting there, you know, jotting down what you're saying. There's no hiding for the actor. You can sort of see everybody and walking past people you know very well. It's just at 3 inches away from them, so it's a different experience really for an audience and for the performer.
Now, Trish, we've got you on today because you work very closely with James V's adapted Geoffrey Bernard Is Unwell, and you specialise in putting on plays in different locations. You very famously did the Tennessee Williams Hotel plays, which I saw twice. First in this gloriously seedy hotel in Holborn, though they probably wouldn't thank me for saying that, but it worked very well there, and then moved it to the Langham Hilton. So tell us a bit why you love doing that before we get on to what you're doing now, because you also did Charles Darwin at the Natural History Museum.
Thanks, Charlotte. Yes, I've seen Robert actually do Geoffrey Bernard last time round, and it's such a fantastic experience. And actually 70 seats is about the size of a really good off West End theatre. So it's a brilliant space to watch it and to be in such a historic location. And James has done a brilliant job in adapting it for people to really feel like they're there with the real Geoffrey Bernard. And he's brilliant at doing the site-specific productions. I met James some years ago when I was working at the Bush Theatre, and he had this fantastic idea to do these Tennessee Williams plays actually in the hotel suites. And Tennessee Williams had lived in a hotel in the latter years of his life and written these sort of pretty unknown 30-minute plays, one-act plays. And James revived them, and we went first to the Holborn in the Grange Hotel in Holborn and did three plays, and it was a complete sensation. People hadn't seen anything like it before. And then we moved on to the Langham, and we had three separate plays, three separate casts, and people would come and they'd start in room 101 and see a 30-minute play, which might be set in 1970s Mississippi, and then they'd move to the next room and see a completely different cast and a completely different play. So over the course of the evening, you saw three different plays, and we had sort of the audience almost like in a train. So we were able to do three different sessions, and it was so much fun and a great success. We then took the idea to New York with the Langham Hotel, and we did Terry Johnson's play Insignificance, which imagines Marilyn Monroe meeting Albert Einstein in a hotel room on Fifth Avenue. And we actually staged that in a hotel room on Fifth Avenue. And the New Yorkers loved it. Again, they hadn't seen anything like that before. So I think a lot of site-specific theatre comes from not only presenting a more creative experience for audiences, but also there's a real lack of venues and theatres in which to stage, you know, fantastic plays these days. There's certainly more plays than there are venues. And so I think, you know, we're always looking for a different way to bring theatre to audiences, particularly new audiences and non-traditional audiences.
Well, talking of that, I've just seen your latest as Trish Wadley Productions, which is a fantastic Othello with Iago played by three people.
Yeah, it's the first Shakespeare that I've produced. And one of the reasons I was attracted to it is because it was a completely fresh take. And I'm passionate about bringing in new audiences to theatre, particularly young people. And Sinead Rush, the director, had conceived this idea, which I believe has been done for the very, very first time, which is to have Iago played by three actors on stage simultaneously, sharing the lines and really delivering that sort of multifaceted nature of Iago's very complicated personality. And she had first done the idea when she was teaching at Central School of Drama, and she taught both Martins Inhangbe and Michael Fox, who's connected by 6 degrees of separation to Robert with Downton. And she taught them this Othello, and they'd done it 10 years ago at drama school, and they really wanted to bring it back professionally. So we've been working on it for about 2 years. We did a round of development at Riverside Studios, and we thought, hang on a minute, this is a great place to stage it. They've got a wonderful smaller studio there, which we recreated the seating in for about 150 people and really brought the audiences very, very close up to a spare presentation of this fast and furious version of Othello, which we will tour next year in the UK, and we're looking at taking abroad because it's a very, very fresh idea. And, you know, young people who came, Othello's on the GCSE this year, came, just went, we were really bored at the idea of studying Othello before we saw this, and now we're super excited. And, you know, that's what it's really all about.
And what was it like doing the first play at the Natural History Museum?
Oh, that was wonderful. And that came out of a need for a venue as well. I mean, I was doing a play about Charles Darwin and his voyage on the Beagle, and I had enlisted the Natural History Museum as a partner because they are stakeholders of the Darwin legacy, and I wanted to make sure I was getting the story right. It was developed by an Australian company, and I thought, well, you know, the Brits aren't going to like the Aussies telling them about Charles Darwin, so I better make sure the experts are on side, including the Darwin family. And we were struggling to find a theatre, and it was during one of those meetings at the museum that I just said, look, hang on a minute, you guys have got a lot of space here. Why don't we just build a theatre here in the museum? And we built a 350-seat theatre in the Gerwood Hall, and we ran it for 5 months. And it was an absolute joy. It was so exciting for audiences to be able to walk into that incredible building. I mean, I still walk past that building and think how lucky we were to have a play there.
Now let's go on to what you're both going to be doing next. Robert, what about you? And it's interesting you've chosen to do this small play. Is it true that your favourite part that you ever played was in Joking Apart?
Well, Joking Apart was great because it was the first sort of sitcom. Well, I'd done other TV stuff before, but this was playing Stephen Moffat, the writer. He'd written a sitcom about his own divorce, and he said he was the only person ever to make a profit out of his divorce. He wrote a farce, and he writes farce very well. And the farce was referred to in the reception of it as not in the pejorative. It was really good artistic farce, but it was both sort of thrilling, but also in terms of its writing and the comic construction of it, was certainly the best material I've ever done.
What about Cold Feet? I mean, that was an absolute cultural phenomenon. Was that what you were expecting when you? It was our sort of version of Friends, I guess, in a funny way.
Well, it started. Yes, well, all shows have to be a hybrid of something else. The adjectives for originality are very. Executives find it very difficult to find them, and so yes, it was tagged as a Friends, but it wasn't ever. I mean, people saw the first series of it, then they realised that it wasn't. I mean, we weren't all living together. I mean, the room as such and the premise of it was just Manchester, and it was just six people and how we rubbed along. So that was as close to Friends it got. And we were a disparate group. And what I enjoyed about it was that none of us could have played each other's parts. you know, we were all sort of right for the role in some ways. And yet, we, although being a disparate group, we were, there was a sort of connection. And as the series progressed, there was a sort of shared history which binded us. And so it was, yes, when we started it, it was Jimmy and Helen's story, really. And it was the pilot was Adam and Rachel. And we were satellite characters. And then they decided to make a series of it, having won the Montreux Gold Award. ITV hadn't rated it, and then it won an award, and ITV decided it was really rather good, and so they commissioned a series, which then built on. We did five of the in the first block, and then four later on in the middle age, and perhaps one day they'll consider doing Cold Feet the Third Age.
Well, I hope so, because it was the biggest treat of lockdown, because didn't the last one come out in about 2020, is that right?
Yeah, we did 2017, we did 4 years of it. And so we had 13 years off in between the first block and the second. And then, in 2026, it'll be the 30 years since we made the pilot. And people are interested in seeing how those characters develop. I mean, I have no idea whether ITV will be interested or not, but I think that it's an opportunity, really, to do a sort of dramatic Seven Up, you know, that documentary,
yeah.
And seeing how people develop, and how people decline, and how people get on. So
I think we've got to start a campaign to get the 30th anniversary marked in some way.
The campaign starts here. Yeah, why not?
Yeah,
but you've never met any of the cast of Friends to exchange notes.
I haven't met the cast of Friends, although Helen was in it. Helen Baxendale.
Oh, of course she was. Yes,
she was in it for a bit of time before we did the first recording. So beyond that, I haven't never met them. No.
And in terms of your audience for Geoffrey Bernard, because Geoffrey Bernard is a particular time and place. I mean, he's sort of 30 years ago when he became a cult figure. Is your audience of a certain age, or do you get lots of young people coming to learn about this cultural figure?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. There's a lot of them are regulars, and there are a number of people who did remember him. But it seems to be a much younger audience in there, people who didn't know him. I mean, I never met him. I read him, but I certainly hadn't met him. I know people who did know him, and they didn't always like him. I mean, in fact, somebody I know who runs a magazine said, "That man tried to kill me." And professionally, when he took over the magazine, it's a celebration of Geoffrey Bernard before 11 a.m. He would, I think, file his copy when he was still relatively sober, and then toddle on to the coach for opening time. And so people used to come and pay homage to him at about 2 p.m, sitting at the deep end of the bar on the same stool, and wonder why he wasn't quite as witty and sharp and delightful as he presented himself in his column. You see, the thing is that what he was writing was an extension of himself. He was an entertainer, and so what he was pouring into his typewriter, relatively sober in the morning when he had to file his copy. He was like any entertainer, like any stand-up, like any comedian in some ways. He's writing an extension of himself. It's a construction of himself, which of course is based on truth. But it went to expect him to be like that for 24 hours a day when people would demand things of him. No wonder he would be truculent.
Well, he was matched in truculence by Norman, of course.
Yes, well, Norman is an actor as well. I mean, I've met Norman, and Norman is at first, you know, first thing he says to you is something rude, but then, you know, his eyes dance, and he's perfectly delightful, you know, so he was also a comic construction of his own making.
Is he still alive, Norman?
Norman is, yes, indeed. Yeah, no, he came to the, I think he's checked in. I think he's booked in to come and see it again. I hear.
Amazing.
He must be getting on. He really must be getting on.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are getting on, and one of them came to one of the regulars from that day, who isn't young, collapsed during the show, and he went down so. I didn't know who it was until afterwards, and it is dark in the corners, and down he went, and pretty hard, and I stopped the show, and. Richard Ingram's wife, Sarah, who's a trained nurse, she went to him and she says she got him back. I mean, he was sort of in a bad way, and I thought he might have gone, and So anyway, I stopped the show and an ambulance was called, and he was taken out. Not the first person to be taken out of the coach and horse's feet first, I have to say. So he went. It was a dry night. He was treated on the pavement, and the ambulance was there. So I eventually just started the show after about 20 minutes, started it again. It happened to be just at the point when Jeffrey Bernard is in the hospital sequence talking about the Grim Reaper and all the friends he'd lost over the years. And the ambulance light was strobing in through the pub as I was talking. So in a sense, the show was sort of at its purest there. But I mean, people did, I mean, being sort of just in close quarters, people did, and it was quite hot. And somebody also collapsed. I was walking, tottering to the door as I was walking through the pub doing my stuff, and patently wasn't that well. So I stopped the show and so took her outside, because there were meant to be people on the door. But they'd gone off for a drink, the staff. So I was left, and this woman, she fainted and she collapsed onto me. And so the stage manager came out, and I took my jacket off, put it under her head and put her into the recovery position, and called the paramedics. And so I was just popping back into the pub every now and again saying, yeah, you have to a couple more minutes. People were perfectly cool about it, and they were just sort of easy. And then you just click and start again. But eventually somebody came to help her, and I was able to restart the show.
Trish, turning back to you now, tell us your big news about next year in Athens.
Oh, yes. I'm actually doing Prima Facie by Susie Miller, made famous by Jodie Comer here in Athens. We've had it translated into Greek, and we have an amazing theatre and actor lined up, which I can't talk about right now. But we'll be announcing with the WOW Festival at the Niarchos Foundation in April. They will be announcing the production with an event there. And it's really exciting. I mean, taking, you know, this wonderfully sort of lauded play to the home of theatre is very, very exciting. Susie will be with me when we announce it in April. So that's later in the year. And I've been working on a play that I think the author is connected to both Charlotte and Robert. The lovely Simon Berry has written a play called The Dame and the Showgirl, yes, which you've both seen. Yes. We did a presentation with Dame Harriet Walter at the Criterion Theatre earlier this year. And we're looking at staging that next year, which is very, very exciting. It's a wonderful play about Dame Edith Sitwell meeting Marilyn Monroe, a meeting which apparently did take place, and they became firm friends. Simon's written a wonderful play, which was number one on Audible during lockdown, with Dame Emma Thompson playing Dame Edith's part.
Yes, Simon was on the podcast telling us about it. It was absolutely fabulous.
So that's on the slate. And I've got another play opening at Sydney's Belvoir Theatre in February. It's a great play which I'm going to bring to London when we can find the right timing, but it's directed by Thomas Kail, who directed Hamilton. It's called Tiny Beautiful Things. It's based on the book by Cheryl Strayed. The play was adapted from the book by Nia Vardalos, who is the creator of My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Can I just say to all our listeners, watch this space. Well, rather watch Trish Wadley Productions space, because everything I've ever seen by you is just fabulous and interesting. And I'll never forget the first hotel plays in that hotel. We all had to scurry down the back stairs to the next room. It was so amazing.
Thank you very much, Charlotte, about those kind words. And literally every year, James and I discuss the idea of bringing back the hotel plays. So watch this space. We very much would like to do it again.
Yes, I mean, doing the Jeffrey Bernard's Unwell is there is a possibility that we might take it further. I don't particularly want to do it in theatres, because I think I really, really enjoy doing it in the pub. So if we can't do it in the Coach and Horses, if that's not available or isn't available very often, I can imagine doing it it's the Fuller's Brewery owned the Coach and Horses. And so what I think an idea, which we haven't actually mooted to the Fuller's, they hear it first, is to do a Fuller's tour, and is to do the play in the pub. So I think it really feels, and I saw it in the theatre, and it works well. But I love doing it in the pub, and just wandering around and doing it in the environment.
Well, I really hope it does do that, and you could take it on a tour of the country. Every Fuller's pub in the country could have
every single Fuller's pub around the country.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on. That was such a treat to have you both. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Charlotte. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Ed. Thanks, Charlotte.
That's all we've got time for this week. But next week, we're going to be talking about a very exciting new exhibition of women's work at Tate Britain that opened on the 8th of November. The show, Women in Revolt, is a major survey of feminist art and comprises work by over 100 British feminist artists. We'll be talking to one of them, Marlene Smith, and to the show's curator, Lindsay Young.
Yes, there's going to be a lot of never-before-seen art on display alongside work of more established artists, and the show's arranged in chronological order. It covers the period between 1970, when the women's liberation movement really kicked off, through to Thatcher's Britain up to 1990. As a trustee at Tate, I can vouch for the fact there's a lot of excitement around this show already, so don't miss it. It runs until April next year.
See you next week. Goodbye.